From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean-Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a true-to-life show about doctors that still manages to get laughs. We'll talk about the critically acclaimed TV sitcom Scrubs with actor Zach Braff and creator and executive producer Bill Lawrence. We'll also hear about Garden State, the well-received independent film starring and written and directed by Zach Braff. And we remember actress Janet Leigh. She died yesterday at the age of 77. She starred in Hitchcock's thriller Psycho and was made famous by the shower scene in which she was stabbed to death. We'll listen to an interview from 1999. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush traveled to Iowa today, where he signed a measure extending tax cuts. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president barely lost Iowa 4 years ago, and the state is a closely contested battleground in this election. Mr. Bush came here today to sign a measure that extends a number of popular tax cuts affecting some 94 million Americans. Among the tax cuts are an extension of marriage penalty relief and the $1,000 per child tax credit. The president said one Iowa family on stage with him will save $1,200 on their taxes. The president later held a town meeting-style event in which he criticized Senator John Kerry's health care proposals as, in his words, creeping towards Hillary care. Brian Naylor, NPR News, with the Bush campaign in Iowa.
Senator John Kerry campaigned today in New Hampshire and Pennsylvania, attacking President Bush's policy on stem cell research.
When it comes to stem cell research, this president is making the wrong choice to sacrifice science for extreme right-wing ideology, and that's unacceptable.
Kerry was joined in New Hampshire by actor Michael J. Fox, who has Parkinson's disease, which is a focus of some stem cell research. A spokesman for the Bush campaign accused Kerry of trying to mislead the American people by implying that the president has banned such research. For the past 3 years, President Bush has denied federal funding for any new lines of stem cells. U.S. military officials say U.S. troops attacked targets in the Sunni rebel-held city of Fallujah today and in the Shiite slum of Sadr City. Hospital officials say the Fallujah attack killed at least 11 people, including women and children. U.S. officials say the strike was aimed at rebels loyal to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. NPR's Peter Kenyon says there was also more carnage today in Baghdad.
There was a car bomb at a checkpoint near an entrance to the Green Zone, fortified checkpoints near where top Iraqi officials and embassy officials work. There were quite a number of casualties, body parts seen everywhere there. It was believed to be a suicide car bomb. And within an hour after that, there was a second car bomb, also described as a suicide attack in central Baghdad, not far from the Baghdad Hotel. Between them, there were more than 20 killed and more than 100 wounded.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. Also in Iraq today, kidnappers released two Indonesian women, but a separate group claimed to have killed an Iraqi businessman who spent many years in Italy and a Turkish man. Arabic television showed video of the men blindfolded before they were shot. In stocks today, the Dow gained 24 points to close at 10,217. The Nasdaq was up 10 to 1952. This is NPR News. This year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine goes to two Americans who've discovered how the nose and brain perceive thousands of different odors. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
The Nobel laureates are Richard Axel of Columbia University in New York and Linda Buck of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. In 1988, they set out to learn how the nose knows the difference among thousands of different odors. They found that smell is not like vision. The eye has only a few different receptors for all colors. Axel and Buck discovered mammals' noses have 1,000 or so different receptors. They get tickled by a staggering array of chemicals, whether from a ripe strawberry, mother's milk, or rotten meat. Each odor stimulates a different pattern of activity among these receptor cells. The brain translates these patterns into odor perceptions. Researchers are trying to mimic this system in devices that could detect disease or danger. Richard Knox, NPR News.
A privately funded rocket plane flew into space today to win a $10 million prize with its innovative technology. The rocket plane, Spaceship One, captured the Ansari X Prize by leaving the Earth's atmosphere for a second time in 5 days. The X Prize requires that a spacecraft capable of carrying 3 people reach an altitude of just over 62 miles and do it twice within 14 days. Spaceship One was carried to an altitude of 46,000 feet by a mothership. It then fired its rockets to reach just past the edge of the Earth's atmosphere. British airline mogul Richard Branson has said that he'll license the Spaceship One technology and use it to offer flights to high-paying space tourists. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Columbia TriStar Home Entertainment, offering Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 on DVD, including 80 minutes of additional features, in stores October 5th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman. Superman.
A lot of what happens in hospital corridors is no laughing matter. But the team responsible for NBC's Scrubs has been working hard for several years now to change all that. We'll talk with two of them today, Zach Braff, who stars in the show, and Bill Lawrence, who created it. Zach Braff stars as J.D. Dorian, who was a first-year resident as the series began, but who now has made it all the way to chief resident. Well, co-chief resident, anyway. Braff has been acting since his teens and got his first big break playing Woody Allen's son in Manhattan Murder Mystery. As a writer-director, Braff got an even bigger break earlier this year. Garden State, the film in which he not only stars but wrote and directed, got a rave reception at Sundance, followed by an equally enthusiastic set of reviews when it was released this summer. Bill Lawrence was on the writing staff of Friends, then co-created the sitcom Spin City with Gary David Goldberg. He created Scrubs in 2001 when it was hailed as the first new NBC sitcom since Friends to bring any quality to Thursday nights. In addition to Zach Braff as J.D., the ensemble cast of characters in Scrubs includes Donald Faison as Turk, J.D.'s fellow resident and best friend, Sarah Chalk as Elliot, J.D.'s former lover and current co-chief resident, and John C. McGinley as Dr. Cox, the hospital's authority figure who speaks very fast and very meanly to all the residents. Here's a scene from a recent show in which J.D., seeking help in inspiring the new first-year residents under his wing, makes the mistake of asking the dreaded Dr. Cox to give them a pep talk.
Ooh, Dr. Cox, can I ask you something?
The answer is yes, it was me who saw you doing leg lifts in the gym on that inflatable ball. It was quite the display of girl power. Absolutely loved the leg warmers.
First of all, they were just big socks, okay? And secondly, if you need to do some laundry, here's the washboard, right?
What do you want?
As co-chief resident, I've noticed that some of my residents are a little overwhelmed. I think it would be nice if you gave them one of your patented pep talks, you know?
I'll be more than glad to give your residents a little pep talk.
Each and every one of you is going to kill a patient. At some point during your residency, you will screw up, they will die, and it will be burned into your conscience forever. Hell, take Pee Pants here.
Pee Pants.
He just might go ahead and get himself a good clean kill this morning, seeing as his patient, Miss Sampson, is in DKA and he hasn't been tracking her phosphate level, her phosphate level, her phosphate level.
Doug! Stop writing and go!
That young man has killed so many patients, I'm starting to think he just might be a government operative. The point is, the harder you study, the longer you just might be able to hold off that first kill. Other than that, I guess, cross your fingers and hope that the guy you murder is a jackass with no family. Great to see you, kids. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Cox.
Zach Braff, Bill Lawrence, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having
us, man.
My first question is to Bill, even though Zach is sitting right there. Why did you cast him in Scrubs?
Oh, a couple of reasons. First of all, Zach is, I mean, the easy one for anybody that's seen the show or seen his movie, Garden State, in your theaters now. Now the, is that
we'll get to that. Settle down. We're like 30 seconds in.
Thanks, Bill. Right off the top.
That's weird. No, Zach is a ridiculously talented actor, and one of the things I was trying to do with the show Scrubs was try to find a way to, in a show, have it cover both dramatic elements and big, broad, silly comedy. And Zach was an actor that had the ability to make the transition between the two very quickly and still have the audience believe it. And besides that, I'm a huge fan of physical comedy. And one of the things that I saw early on in Zach that we were really excited to do was that he has the same physicality that John Ritter had in his ability to turn jokes and pratfalls and make them truly look out of the ordinary. I mean, I'm a lucky guy that the two male leads that I worked with so far on my television shows were Mike Fox and Zach Braff, and I think they're two the best television physical comedians out there. And the other reason that I was really interested in Zach was the character on the show early on Scrubs is playing a young resident at his first day of work at a hospital, and how he's in completely over his head and has all this responsibility. And And I thought that a really cool metaphor for that was hiring an actor that didn't have a whole lot of credits and were basically going through the same thing in their real life, which is to be expected to carry an ensemble show from the outset, having never really had this big break before. And one of the things I think was cool was that, Zach's, vulnerability and, in turn, the empathy we felt for him as an audience showed through in his early performances, partly because of his talent and partly because he was going through the same experience in real life.
Now, were you so convinced of and aware of his talent when you were casting the program that you didn't bother to make him audition?
No. Zach, we did cheat, though, because I tell you one thing, I almost missed Zach Braff, which would have been a huge mistake for the show, because he was living in New York, and the only thing that I had at my avail was him on tape doing his audition.
A bad audition.
Yeah, and I don't even think I saw it at first, because they send you 100 tapes from New York, but that's really hard to measure up against all the people that are just in front of you. But then luckily we took another look at it and flew him out. And the audition process in television is maddening, because you don't truly get to make the choice. You're supposed to bring in 3 or 4 people for network executives who I think if we're honest for a second are really the people that should be judging who is and who isn't funny. They get to basically ultimately make the final decision. So the only thing that we could do to stack the deck is Zach was my first choice after we went through the audition process, and the two of us did a lot of extra work on working jokes and coming up with little physical moments and stuff that we felt the other people might not have, so that Zach could hopefully defeat the system, which is, I think, geared towards picking the middle of the road, unsurprising, unexciting person rather than the new face.
And Zach, what do you remember about the audition process once you got to L.A. and got in front of those executives?
I was very, very nervous. I actually auditioned a total of 6 times for Scrubs. The first time was this time where I was put on tape, and I didn't think I did a very good job at all. And when I got out to L.A., I was able to work with Bill, and it got better. And I think... the process of auditioning for a comedic pilot is so grueling, because you walk into this room and pretty much every time I've ever done it, nobody laughs. This was the first time where Bill was really helpful and really went out of his way to make me and the other people auditioning feel comfortable before we were supposed to go into this really funny scene. And then people in the room were genuinely laughing, which is helpful, because if I've gone to these auditions where you're doing these scenes and they're supposed to be really funny and no one makes a sound. So
that must be brutal.
It's terrifying.
It's a horrifying experience.
I mean,
for these guys.
It really is. It's like the Olympics in a way, that because you can, I went in 6 times and you can go in 5 times and really do an amazing job. But on the final audition in front of the network, which is, 35 people in a very small room, if you don't really land it and do it right that time, then it doesn't really matter.
Talk about the inspiration for Scrubs.
You know what? The greatest thing about this show is Spin City. When I created Spin City, I knew nothing about that world at all. And really, we were just doing a traditional multi-camera sitcom. And the best thing about this show, and the reason I was somewhat protective of it, is it's hard for people to believe, but it was truly real. It's My best friend from college, whose name is JD, and is now a cardiologist in the Los Angeles area and the medical advisor on the show, he and two other of my buddies went to med school. And I think everybody has a group of friends that your frame of reference is when you're a teenager. So you, when you think of these people and when you see them, you regress. And, you know, and my last memory of JD is of a guy, you know, with an empty 12-pack of beer on his head. And and now, yeah, I always used to joke that my worst nightmare in the world as a young 23-year-old would be to wake up in an emergency room and see JD over me going, "You're going to be fine. Don't even worry about it." But as I was sitting with these guys and, you know, just basically drinking a beer and talking, the one through line they all had was how horrifying their internship and residency were. And each one of them just said to me, you know, everybody can imagine that job they had, that first day of work, and how scared you were and how you felt like you were going to fail and that everybody was judging you. And they said, add to that that you're suddenly responsible for the well-being of other human beings and whether or not they're going to live and die, and you would not believe, you know, how all-encompassing and how incredibly horrifying an experience it is. And just that to me stuck something in my head that it would be an amazing TV show. And I've actually been able to, just through those two guys and actually a girl, which would be a title for another TV show. there would be
for about a year and a half.
Yeah, exactly. Just through those three, and through the extension of other doctors, we have not done one medical story or even medical moment on the show that wasn't handed to us by another physician. That's the, you know, we've been embraced by the medical community. It's been one of the best things for us, and a deal that we have out there is that anytime doctors give us stories, you know, we end up naming characters after them. And promising not to use real names of patients or anything like that. But, I mean, as a result of this show, you know, the real JD was the keynote speaker at Brown's med school graduation. I was I spoke at USC's med school graduation. Doctors are the most supportive group that we have. But, yeah, all that stuff's real. And to me, once I talked to all these doctors as far as how the show came to be, I knew right away that it wouldn't be hard coming up with the funny stuff. And not only did I think it would be a great TV show, but to me it made doctors seem very human. And on television, that's not something that in the dramas people don't really do that, I don't think. I think they make them seem so bigger than life and so heroic. And all my friends that are doctors are still goofy, funny guys just trying to get through their day.
My guests are Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence of the NBC sitcom Scrubs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Zach Braff, the star of NBC's medical sitcom Scrubs, and Bill Lawrence, who created the show. It's such a complicated program, and the jokes are so rapid and multi-layered, and there are so many fantasy sequences, and there is no laugh track, and there are so many supporting characters who get some of the best lines. If this was all that way from the beginning, how did you sell it to the network to even get to make it?
This is one of those things, to tell you the truth, that the system worked for me. And it rarely does out here, because I wrote this pilot. You know, it's just one of the only TV shows on NBC that's completely owned by ABC. In fact, the only one. Because I wrote this show for ABC television and got exactly the notes, David, that you would expect to get, which was, how can we do this as a sitcom? And, you know, there's too many characters. And, you know, what if we just make this big, scary doctor and the kid, you know, they end up living together. And I had basically just had my first child with my wife. And so I was, you know, in a position that I was able to say, hey, you know what? No big deal. If you guys aren't that interested in it, I'm not really that interested in changing it. I'm just going to ride this out. And it sat around for about a year and a half, and two people actually championed it. Guys, Steve McPherson, who's now the president of ABC, ran the studio at the time, and a guy named Garth Ancier, who used to run NBC. I really just escaped the system, because what happened was Steve was able to convince ABC that my deal was ending and that they might as well let him show this pilot to other networks. And Garth, I think, was in a place that he was able to actually champion things he liked.
Scrubs actually parallels St. Elsewhere in its construction, in building it around a first-year resident that then sticks around long enough to become, get all the way through the program. And I don't know.
That's just one. That's just one of the many shows we've stolen from, David. I mean, come on. You could say it's.
Am I Denzel in that scenario?
Yeah. What's that? No. I mean, you know.
Well,
St.
now that you're
Elsewhere,
off making movies, yes, you are Denzel in that scenario.
Wonder
Years.
I want
to be the Jewish Denzel.
I don't know. I don't know if that's as sexy as you think it is. But without a doubt, St. Elsewhere was St. Elsewhere like aired. I mean, not aired, but tipped the scales on the other side. I think that was a drama with elements of comedy. You know, and it was one of my favorite shows of all time, bar none. But I think we really tried. You know, the big burden for us that you already mentioned was I didn't want to have a laugh track, and so we knew going into this that we had to pepper this show with jokes and fantasies and make it almost nonstop just to keep the. The powers that be from coming down on us. And the number one complaint about single-camera shows is they aren't funny. And I was just going to do my darndest to never make that happen on this show.
Zach Braff, can you talk a little bit about what you enjoy about your co-stars in terms of the performances they bounce back to you?
Donald, I'll have to start with Donald Faison, who plays Turek. He and I, we just really became best friends in real life. He and I spend so much time together. And I think we just have a really good rapport back and forth. I love just playing around scenes with him. And, you know, before every scene, Bill comes and works us through, and he makes little changes and tweaks jokes. And I love doing that with Donald because he and I have a really good, we work well together. And what can I say? Johnny C. McGinley, who plays Dr. Cox, is, people always ask me, what's Johnny C. like? And I say, he's pretty much Dr. Cox, but a little bit nicer. and I emphasize a little bit. Yeah. We've always had great chemistry, and I've learned a lot from him. He has amazing timing, and I won't go through everybody, but those are the people I most my scenes with. And Sarah Chalk, who became a really good friend of mine, and I love doing scenes with her as well.
One of the other things about Zach with Johnny C. and Sarah and all his other co-stars, one of the things that the cast is nice enough to let me do on this show is we take things from their personal life and from their relationships outside the show and, outside work, and we kind of imbibe their show relationships with that stuff. And Donald and Zach really are that close, you know, and Johnny C. and Zach kind of do have that, you know, reluctant mentor, reluctant student relationship, and... Sarah and Zach have definitely, became friends and had, different experiences with each other along the way. but so it's one of the...
Well,
one of the
wait a minute. Let's not let that one
like,
go
like
yet.
He's not going to stop there.
Yeah. No, because the
Don't
characters...
Worry, it's just local in Pasadena. But.
Right. The characters you see on the program... got very, very close to one another, and then
just one of the rules at our work that I think everybody is cool with is that there's a no jerk policy, so everybody is we enjoy hanging out with everybody. But the other one amongst the cast and writing staff is anything funny that happens in your real life is fair game to be on the show. So everybody knows that if they go through any personal experience with any of the other cast members, or if the writers have anything that they end up talking about, that it immediately becomes part of the program.
Yeah, you'll be sitting at lunch telling a story, and then the next week you'll get a script where your exact story is happening to your character.
That must be comfortable. Well, Bill, how does this explain, say, the character of Krista Miller?
Oh, see, there you go.
That was a good segue.
That's nice. My wife plays a slightly nicer version of herself on the show. And in some ways I take, it's exaggerated, but I take elements of our marriage and just put them right into her character's mouth. And that she's on the show for that reason, because she's really funny, but also because it's the one time a week that I'm actually allowed to tell her what to do and she pays attention to me. at my workplace, I get to tell my wife what to wear in the morning. It's fantastic. I don't like that skirt. It's a little hippie. But no, it's a blast working with my wife. And for other aspiring actors and actresses out there, she has the world's cheeriest gig because she basically just wakes up on Monday morning and says, "I feel like working Thursday." And so and then I gather the writers together and we write her something funny to do on Thursday.
Another couple of questions about what you're trying to do with the characters and with the program.
Sure.
Neil Flynn, who plays the janitor, is he still just the janitor?
His name is janitor.
He's still just janitor, yeah. And Neil Flynn is two things. One, I at the beginning of the series, I truly thought there was no way this show would last more than one season at best because, I felt that I was doing everything wrong in terms of what makes a show appeal to the masses. You know, too many characters, moving around too quickly. Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Neil, if the show ended after 1 year, he was just going to be a figment of Zach's imagination, of JD's imagination. And unfortunately, when the show went beyond a year, he had to start interacting with other people, which was more work. Literally, the midway through the second year, we had a scene with Neil and I think Donald, and he's like, "This is the first time I've talked to somebody else." And Neil is brilliant on a couple fronts. He represents for me, for whatever reason, is one of the things that always made me laugh when I was a kid. Every job I had from the age of 16 to 22 would always start. There would always be one person that hated me for no reason. And Neil represents all of them. I remember one, I worked at a kennel, and I was there for 2 hours, and I just asked this other guy who, you know, I should have realized as a 16-year-old that his job was to go clean up poo-poo, but that I just asked him if I should make sure that all the dog cages were closed tight for the night. And he said, "Oh, because I don't even know how to close dog cages, right, smart guy? That's what you're saying, smart guy?" And from that moment on, even though I'm really not a smart guy, I was smart guy at that particular job. And we just wanted somebody to be terrorizing JD for no reason. The other real convenience of Neil Flynn is he's got a huge background in improv. So one of the great things for us is we pretty much just write an area for him and he says what he wants to say.
Bill Lawrence and Zach Braff of the NBC sitcom Scrubs. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
I could have been a sailor, could have been a cook, a real life lover, could have been a book.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Affordable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, with the new political satire Tanner on Tanner, starring Cynthia Nixon, from creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, series premiere tonight at 9. From Warner Home Video, presenting the 10th anniversary DVD release of The Shawshank Redemption, a two-disc special edition DVD with all new extra features. And by Nonesuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Chicago band Wilco, on tour across the U.S., available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bones sinking like stones, all that we fall for.
Coming up, more of our conversation with actor Zach Braff and executive producer Bill Lawrence of the TV show Scrubs. And we'll hear about Braff's new film, Garden State. Also, we remember actress Janet Leigh. She died yesterday at the age of 77. She played the woman killed in the shower in the classic Alfred Hitchcock film, Psycho.
Places we've grown, all of us are done for. We live in a beautiful world. Yeah, we do, yeah, we do. We live in a beautiful world. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our talk with Zach Braff, who plays J.D. in the NBC medical sitcom Scrubs, and Bill Lawrence, the show's creator and executive producer. One of the things Scrubs does best is allow its characters to surprise one another, and, lots of times, surprise the viewers. Here's a scene from one of this year's shows. In this scene, J.D., Turk, played by Donald Faison, and Turk's wife Carla, played by Judy Reyes, are talking about rap music when two doctors walk up on them. The two are Heather Graham, in her recurring role as Dr. Molly Clock, and Elliot, played by Sarah Chalk. For the purposes of this discussion, it's worth noting that J.D., Elliot, and Molly are white. Carla and Turk are black.
Half of what rappers say doesn't make any sense, like that Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre song. What is still hitting them corners and those ho-hos, girl, mean?
Many disadvantaged African Americans have limited nutritional choices. Therefore, they must subsist on ho-ho snack cakes. It's a black thing, bruh.
Actually, Turk, it's still hitting them corners in them lolos, girl. It's lolos, not ho-hos.
See, Turk, in the hood, a lolo is a lowrider, or a car with an adjusted suspension that allows it to bounce up and down. And Dre and Snoop enjoy driving around together in their lowriders around the corners, or Lizzle Rizzles. I'm representing for them gangsters all across the world.
Still hitting them corners in them lolos, girl.
Still taking my time to perfect the beat, and I still got love for the street.
Turk, you just got schooled on rap by the two whitest chicks in America.
None of you can prove it.
The interracial relationship between J.D. and Turk on the show is probably, to me, the most easygoing, convincing, and nice one, probably since all the way back to I Spy. Do you?
Oh, it's cool.
Do you take it seriously? I mean,
I take it incredibly seriously. I was a horrible stand-up comic when I was really young, and one of the things I always try to talk about was I was a TV kid, and every TV show that I watched in my childhood, and I'm not that old, whenever there was a black guy and a white guy hanging out together, it would be a special episode. You know? Oh, my God, Jimmy's got a black friend. What the hell is going on?
On a very special silver spoon.
Or they would err on the other side, which is, there'd be a black friend and a white friend that hang out and are really close, but miraculously never notice that the other is black and that the other is white. And I, I don't want to trump myself up here, David, but I've had some black friends. but basically one of the cool things is my buddies that we're comfortable with, and, both ways, we would always – one of the funniest things about that those kinds of friendships are just the observations you get to make about whether or not somebody – slides into a stereotype or tweaking, the societal things that people say, and not shying away from it and being comfortable enough with a buddy that you can truly talk about it and shine a light on those things. And it's the aspect of their relationship that we take the most seriously, because we always want to be funny, but we never want to go over to the other side of now you're just using the fact that he's black and he's white to make a kind of a racially edgy joke. It's more important to us that these guys are so tight that they can they can cross lines and they can say things. And to me, it's the way that those relationships should be. But it's really flattered that you asked, because it's something that we pay so much attention to in the writers' room, and we think nobody ever notices.
And that's true in real life too. I mean, Donald and I, as I said, are really good friends, and there's nothing in the world that I couldn't say in front of him and he me. And there's something refreshing about that, about a friendship where all the people who are so PC, especially on television, two characters that just take that apart. And J.D., who's a little more naive, asking Turk questions. I mean, in the pilot, there was a thing about him asking about, what he's supposed to do when there's a rap song on and he's lip-syncing along and the N-word comes up, and just sort of deconstructing things about and political correctness. And I think that's refreshing in a way that you don't see on other TV shows.
And one of the amazing things for us is that Zach and Donald became so tight in real life that I don't just have to draw off of my relationships from my past. And, I mean, in fact, there was there's a show that that J.D. calls he tries to give Turk the new nickname. I think it was Chocolate Bear.
Yeah.
And it was just something that Turk on the show likes it. And yeah, that was something that it was a true moment in our show that Zach said it jokingly to Donald, and Donald was laughing, and I was just observing these two guys that were buddies, and there wasn't any edge, and there wasn't any, oh, my God, you know, and it wasn't even something they stopped for. So,
but we know. Don't recommend you white friends. With
don't
black
try
friends.
This at home.
Don't,
yes.
don't try this.
Don't necessarily do it to a stranger either.
Don't recommend going into work tomorrow and calling your black friend Chocolate Bear. But it was an example of something that, you know, me and Donald, and then he called me Vanilla Wafer. You know, it was just like it was just sort of us joking around. And because it was real, it was something we could put on the show.
Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence of the NBC sitcom Scrubs. Coming up, Zach Braff on his movie Garden State. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Zach Braff, the star of NBC's medical sitcom Scrubs, and Bill Lawrence, who created the show. Zach Braff also wrote, directed, and starred in the film Garden State. I asked him how long he'd been interested in making movies.
I went to film school. I set out to make movies, and when I graduated, I moved to New York, and I was doing sort of all sorts of odd jobs, and I started auditioning as well. And that's when I started to get work in theater and independent film, and that eventually led me out to L.A. and to audition for Scrubs. But my initial intention when I went to school was to be a filmmaker. So I had made a bunch of short films and had pieces of screenplays. And what happened was I got cast in Scrubs, and that day I quit my waiting tables job. And I was so thrilled and screaming to all my relatives and quit that night. And they called me the next day and said we weren't gonna start shooting Scrubs for 4 months. So I figured out a way to live on any of the money I had saved. And I sat down and really hammered out what would be the first draft of Garden State in those intervening 4 months.
The music on the soundtrack, I imagine mm-hmm. that was an awful lot of fun to make those choices, was it?
It was. I really compiled a CD of music that I really love. It actually does relate to Scrubs as well, because on the show, Bill and the writers are always looking for new music for the show. And I always like trying to find new bands, and I have a lot of friends who are musicians. So it's fun because I pitch music ideas to Bill for Scrubs as well. And in writing Garden State, I had lots of ideas for the music I wanted in the movie, and I compiled this CD that I gave out to when I was pitching the script around town and said, and this would be, you know, the ideal soundtrack.
And did you have to take any off because the rights were too expensive?
They were all too expensive at first, but then when we showed them, showed people like Coldplay and Simon and Garfunkel the scenes in which they were used, they really responded to it and were generous enough to let us use their music at a rate we could afford, which was pretty much nothing.
And in Garden State, how did you get to cast Natalie Portman and Ian Holm in particular?
I sent them a script. We never thought they would actually say yes. When you're casting something, you start with sort of archetypes. You say, okay, someone like Natalie Portman, someone like Ian Holm, and then you make long lists of the people that are like them. And we said, all right, well, let's obviously start with Natalie since she's the archetype we're using. And to my surprise, she really liked it. She wanted to meet with me, and we had lunch, and we just clicked, and she said yes.
Are you guys still together as a couple?
So far, Bill has me dating two different women I've acted with.
I made that up.
No, Natalie and I are not together as a couple. We're friends. We're very good friends.
And you and Ian Holm?
I am dating Ian Holm. Great kisser.
Zach, are you directing an episode of Scrubs right now?
I'm about to. I'm on Monday. It'll be my first directorial shot at Scrubs.
We were trying to work some of the stuff out on the way over here in the car. And we're already bickering.
Is this something that you wanted to do?
It's something I've always wanted to do. I joked to Bill that Garden State was my $2.5 million audition reel to direct Scrubs. I love the show and I love the humor of it. And I think a lot of times, you know, we get a new director every week often that'll come in and doesn't know the show as well as we all do. So I think there's times when, since I totally, I feel like I really understand Bill's sense of humor and the way that he likes to shoot things, that it would be a good job for me to try out. And I'm excited to have my first shot at it.
I went from overnight from being somewhat annoyed as to how I was going to get out of the situation of letting Zach direct an episode, and then I saw his movie, and now, you know, I mean, we're lucky to have the guy. He's so good. You know, said it before, nothing is more annoying than how talented he is.
For those of you out there, that's the way that Bill Lawrence gives a compliment to someone. That's the Bill Lawrence way.
But you know, we're lucky to have him, and I'm hoping that this is a good enough experience for him that he'll do some more of them.
And my last question, which I saved till last, only because I'm so embarrassed by it. All the care that you guys put into the fantasy sequences. There was one probably from a couple of seasons ago now. Do you know which one
I'm just I'm just anticipating that it's going to be one of the odd ones.
It is one of the odd ones, and it was one of the characters, and I believe in my memory it was Turk who was fantasizing about Sarah Chalk's character, mm-hmm. in like a sort of a softcore porn nurse's uniform
nurse's outfit.
Setup.
Sure. How's it going?
And I remember this 2 years later, partly because I just...
It was hot.
It was, for a regular family sitcom, it was like, wow, that whole thing was filmed and shot and performed in a way that I couldn't believe that you got away with on network TV. And I figure, there must be a story there.
No, you know what? The only story, truly, David, is that... By working in a creepy, deserted hospital, we've created this environment that the network people don't want to come and visit us. they honestly, because when they drop by there, it's just hot and muggy and no one's ever around. So we basically just shoot the stuff and try to really approach the line as much as we can. Like, we shot some romance scenes or sex scenes with Zach and Sarah Chalk over the years that I thought were, you know, at least PG-13, if not R-rated movie stuff.
I couldn't believe that some of that got on the air.
I know, and basically we just turn it in at the last second and say, this is all we got, and they're just nice enough to go with it. And, you know, and these things all lend themselves to the stories of me talking to the various censors and saying, no, it'll be totally tastefully done. Or, in fact, one of my cherished possessions, David, is they don't, you know, we language is always a tough barrier, especially when you're talking about network television versus cable, because cable, they swear and curse, and I think on network TV you're allowed to say the word ass, but we had said it too many times in one episode, and the censor had sent me a note that I have framed on my wall that she wanted me to not use it 6 times, but to use it 3 times. So the note said, it listed all the page numbers that the word ass was on, and then the note said, please pick your ass. and I guarantee you that she had no idea of the comedy of it, but it's framed on my wall in my office.
Well, that's Bill awesome. Lawrence, Zach Braff, thank you for coming to Fresh Air.
Hey, thanks for having
thank
us, man.
Thank you.
Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence, the star and creator, respectively, of the NBC sitcom Scrubs. Braff's movie, Garden State, is still in theaters. Janet Leigh, who starred in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho as the woman stabbed to death in the cinema's most famous shower scene, died yesterday at age 77. She had suffered from vasculitis, an inflammation of the blood vessels, for the past year. Leigh starred in her first film, The Romance of Rosie Ridge, at age 19. Her other films include Touch of Evil, The Manchurian Candidate, Bye Bye Birdie, and Houdini with Tony Curtis, the third of her four husbands. One of her two children from that marriage is actress Jamie Lee Curtis. Janet Leigh is best known for her role as Marion in Psycho. Marion is an office worker who has stolen some money and is feeling very guilty about it. Norman Bates, played by Anthony Perkins, has invited her into his parlor for a sandwich. He's describing his problems with his invalid, seemingly mad mother. Marion has suggested that he put his mother in an institution.
Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears, and the cruel eyes studying you, my mother there. But she's harmless. She's as harmless as one of those stuffed birds.
I am sorry. I only felt... It seems she's hurting you. I meant well.
People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues and shake their heads and suggest oh so very delicately. Of course, I've suggested it myself. But I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac, a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Yes. Sometimes just one time can be enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Norman.
When Marion is suddenly and brutally attacked in the shower and killed, the audience is stunned. If the heroine of the movie is dead, what happens next? That was Psycho. And Lee will forever be a part of that indelible cinematic legacy. Terry spoke with Janet Lee in 1999 and asked her about filming that famous scene from Alfred Hitchcock's horror classic.
Now, what kind of knife was Anthony Perkins using?
A big, long butcher knife.
Was it was it a retracting knife?
No, it didn't retract. It wasn't steel, however. I mean, it looked like steel, but believe me, it wasn't. Because what people forget is that we could not show penetration of a weapon. So you could never see the knife going in, so you couldn't use a retractable knife. It had no purpose. What you saw was you saw the knife go back and lunge forward, and then you showed the shot of either the shoulder or the tongue or the thigh or whatever, and you in your mind imagined it going in there, and then you saw it pull back, and then you saw it go again, but you never saw it enter the body because it was not allowed.
Now, what did you do, what did you think about to get that look of horror on your face when Tony Perkins pulls back the shower curtain and is there with his knife? Was just being in the moment with Tony Perkins enough, or did you think of other things beyond that?
I think that it wasn't always Tony Perkins doing that with the knife, you know. He had different people doing it.
With stand-ins?
Somebody... a woman at one point, mm-hmm. So that the audience could never get a fix on the character. I mean, they all had the same clothes and wig and everything on, but different people were in different shots so that the audience could never kind of get a glimmer of who it might be.
Oh, you mean so even on screen, we weren't always seeing Tony Perkins?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. He wasn't even there.
Huh.
He was in New York rehearsing a play, I think. And
that's very sneaky.
Yes, of course, but that's Mr. Hitchcock. And because if the same person did it all the time, there was a possibility, slim, but still a possibility, that perhaps the audience might guess it. So by having different people of around the same stature play it and do the scene, the audience was never able to, you know, kind of be long enough to say, oh, that's, couldn't do it. And I didn't really need a lot of other thoughts in my head, because when that shower curtain goes back and you look at this figure, and which is exactly what they did in the thing, you know, I mean, that's pretty frightening. I didn't have any trouble with that.
Janet Lee, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. She died yesterday at age 77. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Janet Leigh, recorded in 1999.
Now, you were doing the shower scene, so although you weren't completely nude, you weren't exactly clothed either. You write that you wore moleskin.
Right.
Because
in
your
in the full shots, where you wanted the body outline, right? I wore moleskin over, where I should. That was, I think, the roughest. Well, one of the roughest things about that sequence, because it's as you know, it's a nude colored, almost soft suede like or something on the outside. And then it's adhesive, obviously, on the inside. And, you know, taking it on and off was very on tender skin. It was painful.
You must have felt particularly vulnerable, because here you are in the shower, you know, knowing that this actor with a big knife is going to be coming at you. But also you've got these crew guys looking at you from on top and from the sides, making you, I'm sure, feel more vulnerable. Were you able to use that vulnerability, knowing that the crew is looking at you when you were mostly naked? Could you work with that and use that for your facial expressions?
Well, I think you use everything, every tool available for whatever you're trying to portray. I always noticed that during this shower sequence that everybody seemed to have a lot of assistance. It was a closed set, but there were more people than I remembered being on that set. I think each electrician had two assistants, and each, grip had two assistants. And one time, one of the most difficult scenes, technically and also for me, was at the end when she falls forward and grabs the shower curtain and goes over the tub. Her head is kind of against that tub, and he starts on a close-up of the eye and pulls back into a long shot. Now, we did it several times. We were in the 20 takes, I don't know which one, 24, 5, something. And because it wasn't automatic focus, it was hand focus, it was a very difficult technical shot for the camera operator, who had to do the focusing as we pulled back. And it was hard for me because of trying to just have a non-live look in your eye, because that's another story about I couldn't wear contact lenses, not enough time. So it was just a hard shot. And around the, 24th or 5th, somewhere in there, everything seemed to be going well. But the steam from the hot water had started to sort of melt the adhesive on the moleskin. And I could feel it pulling away from my bosom. And now, I knew that camera-wise, it would never show. But the guys upstairs on the rafters, the electricians up there, the gaffers, they were going to get a peek. And I thought to myself, well, what do I do? I feel it pulling away. This shot is going well. I don't want to do this shot again. And it's nothing they haven't seen before, so I just said, let it rip. And that was the shot that they printed.
How long did you have to stay there without blinking and, having your eye look dead?
Yeah, well, there was a point where the camera was far enough away that they couldn't tell whether I blinked or not. And he snapped a finger. I don't know in seconds how long, actually, but it seemed forever to me. And the awful thing was that the water was still dripping down my face, and it tickled. When you have the drops coming down your face, and it would tickle, and I couldn't react to it, obviously.
What was your reaction the first time you saw the final cut of that scene?
I didn't see that scene separately. I saw the entire picture. But I have to tell you that I screamed bloody murder. I mean, I really did. Even though I read the script, I'd done the show, I knew what was happening, and I was still here. It just blew me away.
So you mean it was more frightening to watch the scene than it was to shoot it?
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because in shooting it, don't forget, you wait maybe 2 hours while they're setting up the shot. And, of course, the emotion is there when you're doing the scene. But then you relax again for another hour while they do the next setup. In the actual seeing of it, you saw the staccato. You saw the beat of the scene. You saw the mounting tenseness and the mounting, you know, desperation. And that's where it hits you. And the music, seeing that all together, that was what made it emphatic, is putting all the editing together and the music, because otherwise, you know, it was spread out over 7 days. This way I saw it in, 45 seconds, and it was terrifying to me. It's the truth that I've never realized in my life before how vulnerable one is in a shower, and I don't take showers, that's the truth, because you are completely defenseless. I mean, one, you can't hear because the water's running. Two, unless you, you know, have different kind of curtains, which I'm sure afterwards, I know they did. But at that time, you couldn't see out because of the curtain. And you're naked, you're defenseless. And it just terrified me.
Janet Leigh, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Janet Leigh died yesterday at age 77. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, presenting the 10th anniversary DVD release of The Shawshank Redemption. The two-disc special edition DVD is available October 5th. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of Da Vinci Decoded, discovering the spiritual secrets of Leonardo's seven principles by Michael J. Gelb. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Gourmet's editor-in-chief, Ruth Reichel. She wrote about food and restaurants for the New York Times and LA Times before joining the magazine. She's also author of the best-selling memoirs Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples. Now Reichel has edited the new cooking collection, The Gourmet Cookbook. Join us for the next Fresh Air.